It's becoming clear that when you step into the polling booth in just over 2 weeks, you have quite a choice to make. Do you buy Bill Shorten's big taxing, big spending promise to make Australia more fair, or Scott Morrison's promise to get government out of the way of the economy so it can do its thing, increase revenue to spend on services like health and education? Shorten started this week at his Labor campaign launch announcing a $10 billion package to directly boost the wages of childcare workers and access to early education services for working families.
Now, my political philosophy is very straightforward. What we believe in is making sure that the economy works in the interest of working and middle class people. When everyday Australians are getting a fair go, then this economy hums.
It's part of a Labor spending spree that is largely dependent on the $200 billion in revenue the ALP plans to bring in by winding back tax breaks on investments, superannuation and housing.
We want to see the cost of living genuinely tackled. The biggest problem in Australia right now is that everything's going up except people's wages.
The Coalition claims Labor's tax plan will cost taxpayers $387 billion.
Well, let me first say, I'm not going to engage in Bill Shorten's spendathon. As Fairfax reported today, he spent $230 million a minute yesterday.
In Monday's leaders' debate, perched awkwardly on a bar stool, Mr. Shorten used his closing remarks to tell Australians the economy was not working for them.
And of course, the government hasn't kept the promises it's made when it was first elected of proper funding of schools. So this economy is not working for you.
Mr. Morrison's pitch to voters was that Australia can't afford Labor's spending plan or trust it to deliver on its promises. This is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. This week, we look at what the dollars tell us about what kind of governments are on offer. Later in the show, I'll talk with Herald politics editor Peter Harcher. But first, joining me this week from Canberra is Nine political editor Chris Yuleman. Welcome back to Please Explain, Chris.
G'day.
And here with me is our senior economics writer, Jess Irvine. Jess, thanks for coming on the show again.
No worries.
Jess, you've had the fun task, if you could call it fun, of running the 2019 election spendometer for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, which tracks the cost of both major parties' spending, including the cost of the tax cuts. You ran your first porkometer for us way back in 2007. What are the flying pigs showing us this time?
Yeah, I don't know what I did wrong in a past life to deserve this, but since I was a really baby journalist, I think because I'm sort of au fait with spreadsheets, I don't mind a few numbers, I've been thrown this task of trying to keep track of all the spending that just seems to accelerate on the eve of these elections. I've only included the cost of promises over the four-year budget horizon because guess what? What happens in 10 years' time is anybody's guess. So I've costed tax cuts and all the spending over that four-year horizon. And actually, when you do that, I've got Labor and the Coalition about neck and neck. So I've got the Coalition has $19.5 billion of tax cuts. Labor's tax cuts in the short term would cost $16 billion. So the Coalition's a bit ahead on tax cuts. But where the Coalition really comes into its own is with infrastructure spending. So that budget contained billions and billions of dollars of infrastructure, road and rail projects, which they are now sort of running out during the campaign. You sort of go to marginal seat X.
And do you just add those as they announce them, or have you added them from what they announced in the budget as
I've
budgeted
added
for but not yet announced?
You see, this is my life now.
Sorry.
I've added when they've specified the exact project. So they had a $4 billion urban congestion fund. We've actually only included that when they announce it so that you're not doing double counting. But this is the trick. They announce it. They say, here's $300 million for car parks. And guess what? Every day of this campaign, you've had a local member, this is the Coalition promise, in those marginal electorates going, you get a car park, you get a car park. It's been extraordinary. But we are sort of only counting that also when it's announced and you know where the dollars are going. So it's a difficult task, but I think it's really important. I'm happy to do it in a journalistic sense because this is the time when spending decisions get made that are frankly bad, to coin a phrase, to borrow a phrase from Ken Henry. And when he was talking before the 2007 election, every campaign we get billions of dollars promised, rolled out the door, and that funding is skewed inevitably towards projects that the parties hope will get them elected. And that's not necessarily consistent with the policies that will do the most good for the nation.
Right.
So It's a cross I'm happy to bear.
Chris, the overarching theme, it looks like they're both spending, you know, within the ballpark of each other, but they have very different messages, don't they, about how they're spending. I mean, Bill Shorten says he's all about raising revenue to then have spending measures that will increase fairness in the Australian economy, whereas Scott Morrison is all about sort of economic management, keeping the budget under control, getting government out of the way of the economy so that it can do its thing, and therefore revenue will go up to fund services. Do those two messages, do either of them cut through, do you think?
Well, look, those sides obviously hope that they do, and the message that Bill Shorten is sending is that he is prepared to make hard decisions, as he said. Those hard decisions mostly fall on people who make a fair bit of money, and in order to redistribute that wealth to those who don't. And what Scott Morrison is saying, we think that your money works better in your pocket than it does in Bill Shorten's pocket. And that's essentially the two different arguments. But so there is quite a different, very different way approach to the way Australia will be run in future that's coming out in this campaign. So it actually is a very significant one, even though it might not seem like it at this stage. And I think that the argument that Bill Shorten's making to most people is, and once upon a time it was like this, Tory, would you be prepared to pay some more money to get better services for Tory? And Tory thinks, you know what, I'll think about that because I might spend that money better than you do, so let me think. Now it is, Tory, would you be prepared for Jess to pay more money for you to get more services? And by the way, she's a filthy rich bastard.
She is the top end of town.
Yeah, top end of town. You think, oh, wacko, absolutely. You can take money out of her pocket and give it to me. That is really the pitch that's coming out of Labor, because the people that they're hitting do tend to be higher income earners. And the government obviously is saying, you know, our good management buys you all these good things already and we don't need to take any more. But they're taking a fair whack in tax anyway. And one of the things I want to reinforce with what Jess said is there are an enormous number of bulldust figures around where it's time shifted over 4-year periods, 7-year periods, 10-year periods, and even 15-year periods. I'll give you one example. The government's Climate Solution Fund says we know exactly how much we're going to spend on climate change at $3.5 billion. That budget figure is over 15 years. So the answer to that question is, are you serious? I've never seen, in the case Jess has, Jess, have you ever seen a 15-year time period before in a budget?
I haven't. That is a new one. I thought 10 was pretty bad.
We only started getting 10-year budget forecasts the budget before this last one.
Yeah, I actually blame Wayne Swan for that. I remember in some of his last budgets, they were trying to make it clear that they had fully funded the cost of the NDIS. And I think they started doing these sort of 10-year plans to pay for that, because that was a huge 10-year cost.
And I'll give you another one, which is really disingenuous. So we were told that the Labor Party is going to, quite remarkably, pick up some of the funding for the payment of childcare workers. Again, this is something that's very rare. We've seen something similar once before under the Labor government, but this would be quite different. The number that they wanted to tout was a 20% pay increase to that's $11,300 in your hand. And then when they put out their press release, they said that this cost to the budget was a half a billion dollars over the next 4 years, but it's $10 billion over eight. And it's eight where you get the $11,300 figure from. It's 10 years off before you get that. So you have this real mishmash of numbers that's coming out to try and sound like an enormously big figure. And again, the Labor Party's done this quite a bit, is to back end where the cost falls into the problem for another government. It did it with health and education in the Gillard government, which is why it could make the claim that, you know, the out years of health and education weren't being paid for. That's where they put all the hard work.
This talk about the top end of town being hit it's class warfare, really, isn't it? And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I think Bill Shorten has tapped into this issue of stagnant wages. And I think that by trying to address that in an incredibly interventionist and direct way that he has for the very low paid childcare workers, I think he's probably trying to make even people at the middle feel like he's going to do something about wages. Jess, do you think that's going to work?
The do something about wages thing. Yes, this is the new sort of, we will, you vote for us, you'll have higher wages. We'll get the Fair Work Commission to increase the minimum wage to a living wage, however you define that. And guess what? The Fair Work Commission is an independent agency and we're not supposed to tell it what to do. And for childcare workers, you'll just get the money somehow. We'll sort of, I don't know if they're going to get the address of every childcare worker and send a check to their house. It's sort of, it is sort of getting into some fairly exciting new policy development.
But some in the coalition have actually called socialism.
Socialism, yeah. I mean, I guess Labor is unashamedly, we'll tax you more and we're going to give the money to the poor guys. That's what we do. Although they just sort of, they're less sort of blatant about that. They, whenever you say you're going to be a big tax in government, they say, but we're closing tax loopholes. Guess what? It's the same thing. They raise more revenue, so they're taxing more. But, it's a hard sell for them.
I find it, I can't understand how this got through Shadow Cabinet. I can't see how this policy, it doesn't create enormous problems for the Labor Party down the line. Why are childcare workers a unique set of workers? Now, some would say it's mostly female. Okay, so are aged care workers, and they earn about the same amount of money. So why can you make a case for one low-paid workforce that's female against another low-paid workforce that's female? And then there are all the mechanisms for delivery, which Jess was just saying. Does the government pay the employer and the employer pays the employee? In which case, you have to have a bureaucracy to watch that where the money goes, don't you? Because it might be misappropriated. So you'd have to create a workforce around that to help pay the workforce. Or do you send it out through Centrelink so that someone gets their money delivered in that way? And again, how do you go about delivery? So what's the delivery mechanism for this partial nationalisation of the childcare sector? And in the end, isn't this like tipping at an American restaurant? Some of these companies are quite big companies, multinational companies who are in childcare, and we're basically saying we don't expect you to pay their wages, we'll tip.
The other thing that worries me about it is what happens when it's no longer considered fiscally responsible to have this subsidy and they just take it away. And all of a sudden this huge number of Australian workers have their pay cut by 20%.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think there is definitely a problem that childcare workers are underpaid and undervalued in society. Yeah. I mean, we would all probably agree with that. But maybe we shouldn't just write on the back of an envelope, let's send them some money as a policy platform on the eve of an election. It would have been good and it will be good. And hopefully if Labor is elected, they would take a bit more time to go through the mechanics of this.
So if the coalition is spending roughly a similar amount of money to the Labor Party, where is their big ticket? Where is their thing that's supposed to knock everyone's socks off?
For the coalition?
Mm. Apart from the car parks.
There's a lot of infrastructure, you know, this urban congestion busting. There's $3.5 billion for the north-south rail link in Sydney, I think it is. And then there's a very fast rail in Melbourne that's going to get you from Melbourne to Geelong and handily to the marginal seat of Corangamite, which is just south of Geelong. So when you add up sort of they've got about, on my count, about $22 billion worth of infrastructure amount. Right. That they've made since the start of the year, and that budget was laden with these massive sort of shovel-ready. Well, sometimes the projects aren't shovel-ready, so you're being promised it and you might not see it for 15 years, maybe 20 in some cases, but that is where the money is coming in the short term from the coalition.
Yeah, and Tory and Jess, an entirely cynical exercise, because the only way this government wins is to run the narrow path of marginal seats where it believes that it can have a chance, so it has to do two things. Triage in seats where it thinks it might lose, because it's actually starting behind the eight ball on 73 seats because of the redistribution and the loss in Wentworth. It's got to get to 76, so it has to hold everything and then win three. So it's cutting that path by taking all this money and turning it into essentially local council announcements. Scott Morrison is running to be the Mayor of Australia. That's what this boils down to, this campaign.
Complete with dress codes for mayoral events.
Complete with all the stuff that you want. It's basically, you know, vote for us and in 2024 you'll get a tax cut. We'll be good gatekeepers. And by the way, if you live in a marginal electorate, I'll give you a set of traffic lights.
Yeah, I mean, a good example of that, we looked, drilled down into the seat of McNamara, which is in Melbourne. And I think it's been redrawn after some boundary changes, and the Labor MP, Michael Danby, is stepping down there. So I think the coalition have sort of said, this is one area where we're going to go hard. The redrawing of the boundaries makes it notionally more liberally inclined. And some of the stuff, you know, back, if you live in McNamara, you've been promised, you know, the Port Phillips men's shed has been promised $20,000. It's $50,000. I mean, that's a very tiny amount of money for a federal government to be sort of overseeing the distribution of.
Did Tony Abbott get his new toilets at the Curl Curl Surf Club?
Probably. But yeah, I mean, just sort of, why is all this money being taken from taxpayers across the country, funneled all the way to Canberra, and then funneled back to these local communities by parliamentarians who probably, you know, don't spend much time in these electorates anyway, to know which would be the best projects to fund.
And this is the missing heart of the coalition campaign, essentially, that there is no, and I hate to use the word, but sort of no vision for Australia. And that's the contrast with the Labor Party. What Bill Shorten is saying is, I have a big view of the way that Australia is going to run. It's going to be quite different from the way that it runs now. We are going to take money by way of tax concessions off people who have it. We'll lift some taxes from people who are in high income brackets, and we'll redistribute that money to people we don't believe have it. Now, the electoral maths of that is the compelling part, which is there are a whole lot more people who will get benefits than will lose benefits. And mostly those people who lose benefits won't be voting for the Labor Party anyway. And that's the calculation that the Labor Party's done. But it does give Bill Shorten the opportunity to say he's at least making an argument for the future, which appears to be missing from what Scott Morrison is saying.
What is your sense, both of you? I mean, we're still more than 2 weeks from the campaign. The polls, the most recent polls this week, have it tightening on the 2PP. We have a poll coming out next Monday, which will give us more of an idea. But what's your sense on how these two arguments are going for these leaders? Chris?
Well, look, I think that, you know, the campaign-wise, that the Morrison campaign and the coalition campaign has utterly out-campaigned the Labor Party so far. So when you look at that and the sense of momentum that we get from watching that, you feel like that they are gaining ground. And then you get a news poll which says that things are tightening, as they always do. And you think, look, is there a chance? And of course, in any two-horse race, there is always a chance. But I do think that in the end, if it's going to break in any direction late, it will break towards the Labor Party having made the big bet. If it's got the big bet right, and that is that people are up for more government intervention, that we're now living in a world where our wages, or a lot of people's wages, haven't been increasing. They don't feel like they're benefiting. You know, it's all well and good to give a good GDP figure, but if I'm having kitchen table economics that don't add up, then I feel like I want some help. So I think that the big bet that Labor's made is the population's up for more government intervention. It's particularly up for action on climate change. So I don't think that an argument about numbers and modelling is going to be what moves hearts and minds. What moves hearts and minds in this campaign will be, are you serious or not about acting on climate change? And if you seem to be not serious, which is, I think, where the coalition sits at the moment, then that will be a mark against you. So I think in the end, it breaks Labor's way.
So just quickly, Chris, what do you mean when you say that Scott Morrison has out-campaigned Bill Shorten? How has he done that?
So he has certainly seemed to be more confident. He's a much smaller target, so he's harder to hit. He's picked off the big parts of Bill's campaign that are hard for him to defend. And I think the real issue that they had in campaigning the Labor Party was it's a big target agenda, but they're trying to run a small target opposition leader through the campaign. And those two things, you can't square that circle. I've always thought they need to embrace the idea that it's big and say, yes. So when a worker comes up to me and says, you know, I want $250,000 a year, am I getting a tax break? The answer to you, if you're the Labor leader, is no, you're not. You know, you're at the back end of the queue. We might get to you one day. We are taking money from that part of the equation to give it to those that need it more than you do, or some part of your Labor is going to be put to the task of putting a shoulder to the wheel for others. So, and it's been really sharp. So right down to that, they watch religiously what Bill Shorten's doing. So they see him on a carousel at St Kilda. An hour later, Scott Morrison steps up and says, you know, Bill Shorten's on a cost merry-go-round. So they are winning the battle for the pictures
just
in the nightly news.
Feeding the television bulletins.
They think about all these things. These things actually do matter. If you're not paying attention very much to a news story and you see the picture of the carousel and the only line you remember is he's on a cost merry-go-round, well, you know, you win. So I just think it's sharper, better campaign. By the way, in contrast to the dreadful campaign that the coalition ran in 2016.
True. Jess, what's your sense?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think all those things at the micro level, sort of how the campaign is won and fought, sort of really do play into things. I like to take a sort of a bigger step back and sort of look at the macro picture and sort of what happens in the broad sweep of history in Australia is that we elect Labor governments when we feel like the market is sort of not delivering for people. Markets are imperfect, you know, it's not necessarily delivering what people want. There's market failures. We want a government to step in and try and intervene and fix these sorts of things. Inevitably, Labor governments are elected. They intervene. Sometimes they intervene in really bad ways. They stuff it up and they cost a lot of money. So they get things right, they get things wrong. And the Australian public seem to get a bit exhausted by it all. And they sort of switch back to the party of the coalition, which is has that faith in the free markets to sort of sort more of these things out. And we sort of swing from one to the other. And you do sort of wonder if maybe because there are, the economy is weaker and letting the markets flow is not delivering as well for people, that we are on the cusp of sort of going back to a more interventionist strategy that we will ultimately probably tire of and swing back in a few years. But I mean, I guess that's the wonderful thing. That's for the people of Australia to decide. And we'll have a very hard time interpreting that until we see it.
Yeah, and look, if I had to go back to my print days and put a headline on it, I'd say it's the makers versus the managers campaign.
Right.
So it is, the Labor Party would always claim that it's the makers of Australian politics. You know, you think of the big grand schemes that we've got, Medicare, for example, the National Disability Insurance Scheme. It tends to be that we end up arguing about the things that they've made as against those that manage the system really, or argue at least that they manage the system really quite well. Unfortunately, the hole in the argument that the coalition's got about being good managers is, if you're such good managers, why do you keep sacking the CEO?
Yes. Good point to end on. Chris Yuleman, Jess Irvine, thanks so much for being on Please Explain.
Hi, John Sylvester here. I'm the senior crime reporter for The Age. I've been a crime reporter in Melbourne for 40 years, covering gangland wars, outlaw bikies, police corruption, and the underworld of this city. And I've seen a lot of changes in the news business. But take it from me, I believe this newspaper is now filled with the best young news gatherers in decades. This mob produces massive revelations nearly every week, and they're doing stories no one else will touch. And in the era of so-called fake news, we need mainstream media more than ever before. Subscribe to The Age. Support news you can trust.
Herald's political editor Peter Harcher has seen many governments come and go and is a student of the history of the big election spend. Peter, we were both at the Liberal Party campaign launch in Brisbane in 2004 when John Howard made $6 billion in spending promises in one speech. That figure seemed astronomical at the time, but almost quaint by today's standards. Did it work? Did it have the effect he and Peter Costello were hoping for?
Well, it contributed to extending the life of that government, but only until the next big spending election of 2007, where he promised even more. And that wasn't enough to save him. You know, because you reach a point where, while they're obviously aiming for shock and awe type effects with these big numbers and big projects, it reaches a point where shock and awe just becomes recklessness and irresponsibility. And that was the point that that government reached. And when Rudd was prepared to oppose it and call it out, that's when its success came to a shuddering end.
Do you think it also perhaps conditioned people to the idea that, you know, in budgets you were supposed to be given tax cuts and grants for televisions and babies, and in election campaigns you were supposed to be, you know, there were supposed to be announcements with billions of dollars in them, and they just started to become underwhelming?
Yes, I think that's exactly what happened. And you can see exactly the echoes of Howard and Costello in what is being promised today. So, for example, the coalition is promising CCTV cameras for local areas, which, I mean, you're down to the local shopping centre and railway station. This is a local council responsibility, really.
And lots of car parks.
They're and lots of car
announcing
parks.
Announcing lots of car parks at railway stations.
Lots of car parks. Again, it's a council or at most state government responsibility, but these guys have taken it on in a mode pioneered by John Howard to try to somehow make it a concrete, if you'll pardon the pun, connection with people's local lives. But again, it's become, first, as you say, it's become a background noise. People aren't, there's no evidence that people are moved by any of this stuff. And the other thing is it's in a way it's a confession or a concession that they are unable to engage the electorate on the big picture. If they have to reach down into your local shopping malls, CCTV and the local car park at your train station, it's almost a concession that they don't have any big picture offerings. They don't have a national vision, but look, here's a CCTV camera for you.
So Bill Shorten, on the other hand, has taken what looks, to, from my perspective, to be quite a big political risk. I mean, he is brought in a whole heap of revenue measures that are not uncontroversial in order to then go and pay for what looks like a major redistribution of wealth in this country. Can you talk us through what he's promised and what sort of shape he is trying to give his message at this election?
Yes, it's a very unabashed attempt to make the argument for fairness and to be the candidate for fairness. And the big picture is, as he said to me last week, we tax income too heavily in Australia and we don't tax capital heavily enough. And apart from income earners in the top tax bracket, he's attempting, he's promising, he's promoting the idea of cutting tax on income for medium and lower income earners and increasing tax on the owners of capital. And in particular, he's not going all out, but investment property with the changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax, and also to self-funded retirees who are currently getting the dividend imputation cash refunds. And this is an unabashed, it's a tax grab, but he says it's by eliminating unfair loopholes. And that tax then goes to not only the tax cuts for middle and lower income earners, but these big ticket programs. So, the cancer project to cut the out-of-pocket costs for people suffering cancer and being treated for cancer. The dental program for pensioners that he announced this week. The wage subsidy for childcare earners. These are, you know, bam, 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 areas where middle and lower income people are getting a hard deal, according to Shorten, and he's going to top them up. In the process, while these are great campaigning points, he's actually setting up what I think are some fairly poor public policy points. For example, nobody would argue that we shouldn't assist cancer sufferers with their out-of-pocket treatment costs. But what about the 100 other fatal diseases that Australians are dying of this year? And the childcare wage subsidy, it's a direct federal government subsidy to childcare workers' wages. Now,
that seems amazing to me. I can't.
It is.
I can't think of another opposition leader or prime minister that would have attempted to take public money to pay people's wages.
That's right. In recent history. And it's not a. I mean, there are other subsidies, wage-related subsidies. For example, if you're an employer and you hire someone over 55, or some disadvantaged groups, you will get a wage subsidy for the first few years from the federal government. But this is just a direct payment to income earners, to childcare workers. There's no concession expected in return. There's no trade-off. This is a straight-out handout from the federal government.
And no structural change to the childcare industry.
No structural change. In fact, we've yet to see whether they're going to put any safeguard measures on this to make sure that in the federal government handing you the childcare worker an $11,000 wage increase, why wouldn't your employer just say, oh, so we don't need to give you a pay increase for the next few years now because the government's doing it. So there are problems like that. But the big one I see with this is in trying to address the inequality of childcare workers who do tremendously underappreciated, underpaid work of tremendous social value, is what about all the other occupations that do the same? What about the nurses? What about the disability workers?
Aged care
workers. Now, Shorten said, oh, well, this is the first cab off the rank. And then the next day he said, no, this is unique and there won't be any others. Well, which is it? Why is this unique? What about the others he's storing up problems for himself if he, in fact, wins this election, because every union in the country is going to be at his door saying, well, you gave it to the childcare workers. Now, what about my members, Bill? How much pressure can he withstand from the ACTU? How much pressure can he withstand from the union movement if and when that happens?
Now, he would have gone into this quite shrewdly recognising that wage stagnation in this country is a big issue for people and across the board, and that's not just in the low-income, low-paid workers, but, you know, in the middle as well. Wages are very flat, and would have sensibly thought that campaigning on wages was a good idea. But he has certainly taken the rhetoric. He keeps talking about the top end of town all the time when he's talking about tax changes that he's bringing in. But a lot of his changes will not just affect the top end of town. They'll affect the middle class. Do you think it's going to work? Or do you think that people will buy Morrison's retort that, you know, he is just trying, like, we don't know how big the bill is going to be, and that he's going to get in the way of economic growth?
Well, I think that people are open to the concept. In fact, people already have the impression that inequality in Australia has got worse. And partly it's income inequality and lagging wages. And a shortened favourite line is everything is going up except your wages. The other inequality that he's really latched onto, and this does work to his advantage insofar as he can get people to hear his message, is the intergenerational inequality.
Mm.
And this is about climate change. This is, you know, my generation, Tory, which is, I think, is a little, we're a little ahead of your generation, being responsible for maybe not destroying the earth, but failing to act to save the earth once we've comprehended the problem, and leaving a degraded planet for our kids and grandkids. Likewise, the property market. You know, our generation, we all think we're investment geniuses, but all we did is ride a rising property market and price our kids out of being able to live in Sydney and Melbourne and other parts of the country sometimes too. So these, by correcting that with his changed policies for negative gearing to take heat out of the investment market and therefore try to moderate property prices with his plan to deal with climate change, he's trying to attack that intergenerational perception, the idea that we're going to leave our kids worse off. So he's doing all of that. Now, your question is this vulnerable to a Morrison scare campaign? And I would say to you that everything is vulnerable to a good, well-conceived, well-run scare campaign. Morrison's having a good old crack at that. I don't think they've quite hit it yet, but they've got 3 weeks in which to hit it pretty hard, and we're going to see a very heavy emphasis on attack from the Morrison government.
Well, we've got new Ipsos polling going into the field this week for publication on Monday, Peter, in our papers. It'll be really interesting to see if there's any shift in that, but just what's your feeling about how the campaign is going for the two leaders?
Well, the conventional wisdom is to say that the race is tightening and that the polls are tightening. The two polls that we've seen this week, the major credible polls, the News poll and the Essential poll published yesterday in The Guardian, they do show on a two-party preferred basis a 1 percentage point movement in favour of the government. So the government, instead of being 2 percentage points behind, is now 1 on both those polls. Now, on the one hand, maybe this is a sign of something underlying changing, but you can't actually make that case because these polls both have a margin of error of over 2%. So, in other words, everything that we've seen is within the margin of error. It's you would have to be relying on some other sort of oracle if you're going to make the case that the polls have tightened, because we just don't have the evidence for that. So this poll that we're producing early next week will be interesting to see whether it can confirm there's a movement or not. But the other thing I would say about this campaign, and that this should have both parties worried, but especially the government, because the government is the one that most needs to shift votes to win, is the level of disengagement that we see with the election, with the electorate. The mere fact that, you know, Channel 7 feels vindicated that they screened the first leaders' debate on their number 2 channel, with the old reruns, tells you that what they thought about it. And the fact that the Guardian poll yesterday had 50% of the country saying they're either paying no attention or little attention to this election, and only 1 out of 5 people saying they're paying a lot of attention.
Well, we must have the tragics, because Please Explain's quite popular at the moment, which is nice to know.
Oh, our readers, our listeners, they're engaged, they're informed. We're the happening set.
Yeah. Peter, we'll have you back on the podcast before the election. Thanks for your time.
Pleasure. See you, Tori.
Thanks to our guests this week, Chris Yuleman, Jess Irvine and Peter Harcher. If you're a Please Explain fan, we'd love for you to tell others about the podcast and leave a review on iTunes. It's one of the best ways for new listeners to find us online. And of course, you can get in touch with the team. Find the Please Explain email address in our show notes. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. The best way to support the work we do is by subscribing. Just search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age to get yourself started and unlock heaps of benefits. This episode was produced and edited by David Escort, field recording by Debbie Harrington, technical assistance from Yuji Shimada. Special thanks as always to Amelia Maguire, who does our production logistics, and to Tom McKendrick, our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.